Chapter 4.
Sleepwalking.
Quite apart from the twice daily tidal rise and fall of the Misericordia Canal, life outside my window had a special rhythm of its own. Typically, the day began in the pre-dawn stillness, when a fruit and vegetable dealer stepped into his boat moored opposite my window, gently started his motor, and chugged slowly and quietly down the canal, the equivalent for a motorboat of tiptoeing. Then everything fell silent again, except for the lapping of water against the stones. At about 8 o'clock, life along the canal officially awoke, as shopkeepers on the other side started opening their doors and rolling up their metal gates. Giorgio set his tables and chairs out in front of the trattoria. The butcher took delivery of meat from a passing barge. Pedestrians began moving across my field of vision like actors crossing a stage. A laborer shambling unhurriedly, a man in a business suit walking at a more purposeful pace. Customers stopped in at the trattoria for coffee and a glance at the morning's gazzettino. Next door, at the local communist storefront headquarters, with posters bearing the hammer and sickle insignia on the walls, there were generally one or two people sitting at a desk, talking on the phone or reading a newspaper. The small shop next to that one had been the workshop of Renato Bonà, one of the last Venetian craftsmen who specialized in making oars and oar posts for gondolas. Bonà's genius as a sculptor, particularly his mastery of the curving, twisting oar posts, had made him a demigod among gondoliers. Since his death 2 years earlier, his shop had become something of a shrine, commemorated by a plaque next to the door. The Misericordia Canal was not on any of the usual gondola routes, but every so often a gondola would glide by in silent tribute to Bonà. One gondola, however, had its regular mooring spot in front of the house. It was a wedding gondola, so it had elaborate carving and ornamentation, but it was still black like all the others. At some point during the day, the gondolier would ready it for a wedding by putting gold and white slip covers over the chairs and cushions. At 1 o'clock, the rolling of metal gates sounded again as the shops closed for midday. Only the trattoria stayed open, serving local seafood specialties to a predominantly neighborhood clientele. The pace of life slowed until late afternoon, when the shops reopened and people walked at a quickened step, students released from class, housewives hurriedly shopping for dinner. As darkness fell, the metal gates rolled down again, and the lights of the trattoria came up at stage center. People moved now at a leisurely stroll, and convivial voices floated in the nighttime air. Toward midnight, the sounds of boats and backwash died down. The voices drifted away. Giorgio dragged the chairs and tables back inside and turned off the lights. By that time, the fruit and vegetable dealer had long since tethered his boat to its mooring poles, and Pino, the owner of the white water taxi, had pulled a canvas sheet over the open part of his deck and retired to his apartment above the communists. Venice could be a disorienting place, even for people who lived there and thought they knew it well. The narrow, winding streets, together with the serpentine course of the Grand Canal and the absence of any landmarks visible from a distance, made it difficult to keep one's bearings. Ernest Hemingway described Venice as a strange, tricky town, and walking in it as better than working crossword puzzles. To me, it occasionally felt like walking through a funhouse, especially at times when, 20 minutes after having set out on a course that I had thought was a straight line, I discovered I was right back where I started. But the streets and squares of Canareggio became familiar to me sooner than I expected, and so did some of its characters. I had been in residence barely a week when I met the plant man.